Good morning, Council. Our final case on the docket this morning is In re the Appeal of Maren Erickson for Maltreatment of a Minor, case number A231084. As both counsel, I'm sure, are aware, you will have 15 minutes for your arguments, and appellants, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. You can adjust the podium height. Please feel free to take the time to make sure that you're comfortable. With that, counsel for appellants, if you are ready, you can approach the podium.
May it please the court. Counsel, I'm here today representing the appellant, Ms. Erickson, to correct an egregious decision made by the Commissioner of Human Services and a rubber stamp approval by a district court who did not properly review a record, who did not provide Ms. Erickson, the appellant, with the review that she's entitled to under law. We're asking the court today to determine that the district court did not do its job in reviewing this case and protect the appellant's rights in cases like these, in which the decisions of these agencies, when they go unchecked, have substantial effects on their freedom, their liberties, and their jobs in cases like this. These are serious cases that seem to just be overlooked by district courts, and so we're asking this court to take it seriously and to hold the district courts accountable for what they're required to do under law.
Counsel, even if we agreed with you in terms of the errors that you talk about with regard to the district court, given that we have, de novo review of these questions, in these cases, the district court is sitting as kind of a middle appellate court, why wouldn't it just be appropriate for us to look at the record and make these decisions, even if the district court did make those errors?
For two reasons. And first is the limited record that the district court had to begin with, which is outlined in the brief, but then also
But the agency is the initial decision maker, so they're the ones who create the record. When the district court is sitting as an intermediate appellate court, it's not their job to create the record. They need to review the original decision maker's record, correct?
That is correct. However, in this case, when we filed it with the Court of Appeals, there was some pre-briefing motions regarding whether or not a transcript was going to be prescribed to the Court of Appeals here. And the Court of Appeals granted our request to not issue a transcript of the commissioner's hearing at the DHS court because the district court did not have an opportunity to review that transcript. And so this court is tasked with reviewing that same record. And additionally, there was no transcript of any district court hearing because one was never given.
But your client had the obligation. I mean, if you look at Rule 115.04 of the Minnesota Rules of Civil Appellate Procedure, it's your client who had the obligation to order a transcript of the fair hearing from the agency. So, I mean, my understanding of the way these agency actions work is you have the fair hearing, and if your client thinks a transcript is necessary for deciding the case, it's their obligation to order the transcript from the agency, which the agency would then transmit to the district court. And so the fact that there's not a transcript here, the agency had no obligation to make a transcript of the fair hearing without that request from your client.
Understood. And I think part of the issue comes to the fact of the district court didn't provide any kind of guidance on what they were looking for. In fact, we requested a hearing in this matter when we first appealed to the district court, and then when the briefs were submitted to the district court, they provided no guidance on if they wanted to review a transcript, if they were reviewing the audio footage or the audio of the hearing.
But is it the district court's responsibility or is it the party's responsibility to provide the record to the district court, similar to what is required to provide transcripts and documents to the Court of Appeals?
Correct. To the Court of Appeals, yes, that civil rule of appellate procedure does apply in a case like this. However, the argument is that the district court didn't get a chance to review that, and additionally, there was no
communication. But they didn't get a chance to review it because your client didn't order it from the agency. The agency didn't have an obligation to give that transcript to the district court without it being ordered by your client.
I agree. And part of the reason that we had requested a hearing by the district court is so that we could address that with the court in order to say,
But you had 14, I, I believe the rule is that you had 14 days after you filed the appeal with the district court to request a hearing or to request the transcript of the hearing from the agency. You don't need to have a hearing with the district court judge in order to order that transcript under Rule 115.04.
We don't. That is correct. However, we anticipated the district court would review the audio, and it appears that they did not, and that comes to the...
What evidence do you have that the district court did not review the audio? Isn't there actually evidence in the record that the district court did? Didn't the district court refer to the audio?
The district court, in its order, spends 3.5 pages essentially copying and pasting the findings of fact from the Commissioner of Human Services, and then they spend about 1 page citing supposed substantial evidence that supports those findings, but they don't, there's no citations in it. It's more of rearranging the words of the district court order. It doesn't make any kind of citation saying, according to this timestamp or on this page of the testimony or anything like that.
Agree. The district court does not have citations to the record, but it's not required to. It can issue an order and basically have citations to case law.
Well, that's correct.
But which is, in fact, the practice of, like, our court. We tend to not put the record citations into our own opinions, even though we are reviewing the record.
Right, and the respondent in this case cited several uncited or unpublished opinions, but I think that outlines the crux of this argument in that there's some, if this court were to adopt the holdings of those cases, would establish some very dangerous precedent. One of them was the welfare of the child of JS, which is an unpublished case, which states that there was, it's reasonable to assume the district court reviewed the record. But another case that they cited was Ahmed versus Nicola County Health and Human Services, where the Court of Appeals opined that the Health and Human Services judge's failure to make an audio recording of the evidentiary hearing didn't on its face invalidate the decision of the commissioner, nor did it automatically prejudice appellant's due process rights.
But here there was a recording of the hearing. It's that your client didn't order the transcript of the hearing is what you are arguing the problem is.
Right, but and I'm arguing that there's...
And so this is a less egregious case than the cases that respondent is citing to because there is a record of this hearing. It's just that your client didn't order the transcript for it.
Right, and with an understanding and an assumption that a district court would properly review the record, but the current law, the unpublished case law regarding around this, is saying that we assume that the district court's going to review this record, but we also don't require them to even record the hearings. It's this nebulous space that doesn't actually check the agency's unfettered power to make these egregious decisions here. We're talking a decision coming out 4 years after the first abuse was reported, and the agency runs wild with it, and then when she's asked for court review.
Can I stop you just and ask a little more fundamental question?
Yeah.
Okay, so we're reviewing the commissioner's decision, right? And so my question is, what is it, let's assume we agree with you on everything, that and that it's a problem that we don't have this audio recording, and set aside whose job it was to make sure that came before us in the district court and the transcript, what is it in that audio recording and that transcript that you're representing made the decision of the commissioner wrong? Because a lot of the commissioner's decision is based on documentary evidence. And so, you know, we can review this record de novo and look and find a lot of evidence that arguably supports the decision the commissioner made even without having the audio recording.
Right, but the court needs to find that there was substantial evidence that supports the findings of the commissioner. And I think having a four-hour hearing about this where there's testimony specifically from the appellant in this case can go towards whether or not that substantial evidence exists.
But you never make any specific point in your brief as to what that testimony would have been that would have invalidated and shown that there was somehow not substantial evidence to support the commissioner's decision. So is there something that is in that testimony that you're pointing to shows some sort of error that we should be reversing?
Well, there's a number of issues, including the sufficiency of the evidence in the sense of that, and this is cited kind of in our argument talking about the previously investigated or lack of investigation regarding the allegations that were originally reported by Ms. Erickson by the appellant. And so these documents, including the document that she provided showing that she called the Child Protection Services to make her own report.
But is that your argument that there's some sort of a bar on any future maltreatment investigation simply because previously an investigation came in and was purportedly screened out, is it? I mean, that would be a pretty shocking position to have for child protection in Minnesota.
No, not an outright bar, but we're saying in this case, when provided with the whole record, it shows that if a report came in that a child was, say, suicidal or depressed, like there was in this case, right, it's not a de facto reason to conduct a screening for maltreatment of a parent. The investigation
here... Absolutely. They need to consider what the parent's doing in response to that and what the underlying causes are. And right, wasn't that what animated the maltreatment finding in this case, is that it wasn't simply, as you argued in your brief, that the child protection investigator was finding that any parent of a suicidal child has committed some sort of neglect, but rather the particular circumstance of this case where the child is responding to something that happened, is still living in the home with the person that at that point allegedly perpetrated it, and the response of the adult in the home was not to have that person move out, and instead there was, according to the mental health professionals who were speaking to the child, a blame being placed on the child. And that's what's driving the mental health concerns at that point. At least that's what the basis for, at least part of the basis for the maltreatment investigation was, right?
Correct. But we can't look at just this report without looking at the 2016 report in which Ms. Erickson testified, provided records that she had made a report to Child Protection, that it was screened out, and she had essentially relied on that in making her decisions moving forward. And then this maltreatment determination was based on a request by the agency to have the other child move out of the home. These two are so intertwined that you can't consider one without the other. It was a request that he move out of the home, that her child be forensically interviewed, which they did behind her back, which then exacerbated her condition, and it led to her partial hospitalization.
I can see your point about substantial evidence. If it was simply this happened in 2016 and everything is copacetic when it's being investigated, but that's not our facts, right? I mean, the case that's before us is, we have what happened in 2016, and we have a child that's in mental health crisis based on what happened in 2016 and the current condition. So how do we, as you say, they're intertwined. So how do we rule in your favor in saying just because it may have been screened out in 2016, the child protection investigator and the commissioner should have determined there's no neglect going on now?
Well, the agency overstepped in a number of ways in saying that there could certainly be a risk to her child at this point. But the fact of the matter is one, I'll start with this, that the world was in the middle of a pandemic at the time, and there was concerns about whether or not there could be safety in the children moving out of the home. The
commissioner made a credibility determination about all that. Aren't you asking us to reweigh the evidence? I mean, that's not our role here. We're doing substantial evidence review. We have to defer to credibility determinations that were made, right?
Right, when it comes to credibility determinations. However, I'm going to backtrack a little bit here, but it wasn't just that part, but it was also the decisions made by the agency were so egregious to exacerbate the mental health concerns of Ms. Erickson. Specifically indicated that she was worried that a forensic interview at this point would exacerbate the conditions, and that proved to be true when the agency went behind her back, conducted this forensic interview. 4 days later, her daughter was admitted to partial hospitalization.
But even if we assume all of that is true, it doesn't necessarily change that there was substantial evidence to support the agency's decision that neglect occurred here.
I respectfully disagree in the sense of that if Ms. Erickson, as a parent, does have leeway to make decisions what she views is in her daughter's best interest.
But what we are reviewing is whether there is evidence in the record to support what the agency did. We don't get to say if we would have analyzed this different. We would have analyzed this differently and said that this was not neglect. That's not the standard that we're applying. The standard that we're applying is there enough evidence in the record to support what the agency did here? And so I think even if we assume all of the facts that you're contesting, I mean, where is the lack of evidence that neglect occurred under the facts of this case? Even if we assume everything you're saying is true.
And I think these facts are in the record, and I don't think the district court and the commissioner's record is supported by it. And part of our argument here is that the district court did such a disservice that these agencies, when they run rogue like this, that there is no...
Well, I actually think that the district court was pretty sympathetic to your client. When you read her order, I think that she's pretty sympathetic to what happened here. I think that she credited the evidence that your client submitted in terms of that she had actually made this report in 2016 when, you know, respondent even here is arguing that that report didn't happen. And so I think that when you're saying that the district court didn't actually look at these facts and didn't see the course of conduct from the agency in this case, I don't know that that's supported by the language in the district court's decision, because to the extent that it departed from the agency's findings, those findings the district court found were favorable to your client.
There were some findings that were favorable to her, but the vast majority of that order is a recitation of the commissioner's findings. Over nearly four pages of it were copied and pasted parts of the findings of fact, and then just a few pages, not even a page, of a few bullet points of what they determined to essentially be supported, but they don't make any of those specific citations. And I see that my time is out.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel, for respondent, you can approach, and if you'd please identify yourself and your client for the record. And adjust the podium.
Just about a foot. Good morning, Your Honors, counsel, and may it please the court. My name is Britta Nicholson from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, and I am appearing this morning on behalf of the respondent in this case, who is the Hennepin County Human Services and Public Health Department. I would like to begin by addressing appellant's argument and claim that the district court did not have access to an audio recording or a transcript of the fair hearing.
Counsel, could I start with an initial question, which is the appropriate standard of review in this case? I think that there's an argument. I think that there's some indication that the standard is clear error, but my understanding is that under Zoller that this is a 14.69 case. Is there anything about sort of the district court being an intermediate appellate court that changes the usual standard of review for appellate decisions?
I think you're correct, Your Honor, that in this case, since the district court was acting as an appellate court and now we have two phases of appellate review, I believe the case law, including Zoller, is clear that it's a 14.69 standard of review, where it is the substantial evidence test. And as noted in one of the cases I cited in my brief, I believe it's the Ross case, they held that if the district court were to or if they were to review the district court for clear error, that would be beyond the scope of review, because the district court in these cases isn't tasked with making independent findings of fact based on the record. The district court is applying the 14.69 substantial evidence test to see whether the commissioner's order was supported by substantial evidence. So as argued in my brief, I don't believe this court's role is to review the district court's order for clear error. It's to go back to the commissioner's order and to determine whether there was substantial evidence in the record to support the commissioner's decision.
And under 14.69, even if we did think that the district court had erred in its review of the record, we still, a remand to the district court wouldn't be necessary, because really we're sitting as a court we're sitting as a superior appellate court to the district court, so we're really just reviewing what the commissioner did.
I agree with that, okay. Your Honor. So turning back to the argument regarding the record that was provided to the district court, upon my review of the record that was provided, the audio of the fair hearing was, in fact, included. It is referenced repeatedly in appellant's filings with the district court. For example, appellant's counsel requested an extension for their brief so that they could review the four-hour audio recording of the fair hearing. And in addition, in preparation for my brief, I received the record provided to the district court from the Attorney General's office, and that record did include an audio of the four-hour fair hearing.
It's just not part of our record on appeal here, which is the trouble with it, right? I mean, the district court record is somewhat opaque because of the confidential nature of the filings, and we can't necessarily rely on what you reviewed, you received from the Attorney General in your representation. But at the end of the day, as you just pointed out, it may not matter because we're just reviewing the commissioner's decision anyway, right?
Correct. And it was my understanding that the district court, based on the filings I could see, that the district court was supposed to provide to your honors the record it received and reviewed in its capacity as an appellate court. So I then, since I could not access it as it was confidential, I then requested the record that would be provided to your honors, and it did include the four-hour audio of their fair hearing. But I do agree, Your Honor, that might end up being a distinction without a difference, because even if you look purely at the filings at the district court level, as I mentioned, it was very clear from those filings that appellant had access to an audio recording of the fair hearing in their possession. They requested additional time to review it, so it was well within appellant's power and ability to provide that four-hour recording to the district court so that they could make their arguments based on the audio recording.
Well, appellant doesn't have any obligation to create a record at the district court. I mean, the agency is the decision maker. So they're responsible for creating the record. They're responsible for supporting their decision with the documents that were provided at the record, and they're responsible under Rule 115.04 to provide that record to the district court, in this case, under Rule 115.04. And so, I understand what you're saying in terms of they could have submitted the record, but I think that it was the agency's obligation to submit the record to the district court. It's just that the appellant, in this case, under Rule 115.04, chose not to order a transcript of the fair hearing, which they also could have done, which would have then been transmitted by the agency to the district court. Maybe that's just a nuance, but I don't think the appellant had the ability to create a record in the district court once the record had been created at the agency.
And I'm certainly not saying that the appellant had the burden to create any type of new record beyond what was presented during the fair hearing at the commissioner's level. What I'm saying is that there is case law, which I cited in my brief, that stated that the appellant has the burden, and the district court, again, is sitting in appellate capacity as an appellate court. And on appeal, the appellant has the burden of providing an adequate record for what they consider to be their appellate issues. So in this case, they did request an audio of the fair hearing. They did receive it, as noted in their district court filings. So they then had the burden to then take the next step, and if they wanted the district court to review that audio, they should have provided it to the district court. In addition, as Your Honor pointed out,
but the agency under Rule 115.04 has an obligation to submit the record to that they relied on for their decision-making to the district court. And so, I mean, if you read Rule 115.04, the way that it works is, Even if appellant wanted a transcript, they have to order that from the agency, pay the agency to create the transcript, and the agency then transmits that to the district court. I don't think the appellant has any power to create a record once this case goes to the district court. All of that record development is supposed to happen within the agency itself. I mean, that's just sort of basics of administrative law.
And what we have here is the agency did record the fair hearing and did provide a record, an audio recording of the fair hearing to the parties in the case. And as Your Honor noted earlier, if appellant found that to be inadequate, appellant could have requested a transcript. Appellant could have created a factual summary of the record as noted in Rule 110. Appellant had many opportunities to remedy this issue at the district court level and did not take advantage of any of those opportunities. At the district court level, appellant was comfortable to rely on the record as submitted to the district court, didn't raise any concerns at the district court level about any inadequacies in the record. So another way to look at this would be from a waiver perspective, that appellant was fine proceeding with that record as presented to the district court at the district court level. Appellant was comfortable with the district court reaching its decision based on the record as presented. So now when it was an unfavorable decision, the appellant is trying to have a second bite at the apple and saying, well, now I want a more robust record. Not simply permissible under the law.
Can I interrupt for a second and just turn toward the merits?
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, you would agree at the very least that this is somewhat unusual of a maltreatment investigation, maybe not in your experience, but given the passage of time since between the initial acts and the fact that there's evidence, at least some evidence, that Ms. Erickson attempted to contact the Child Protection Social Services, there's those phone calls, we don't know the content of them, there's the efforts she made to get the kids into therapy, get a psychosexual, at least the beginning stages of that. And I don't think there's any doubt from the record about her care for her children, including, you know, the victimized child in this situation. Why is there substantial evidence that supports the commissioner's decision in this situation?
Well, Your Honor, as I mentioned and argued in my brief, there is actually evidence to the contrary that appellant did not call this into child protection in 2016. There's also, well, she did testify and make claims that she got a psychosexual, that they extensively addressed this in therapy. Those, in fact, turned out to be not true when the investigator followed up on those claims. The perpetrator in this case, in fact, only completed a diagnostic assessment, and then when that assessor attempted to call appellant back in order to complete the psychosexual, he never heard back from her. The perpetrator in this case, even when he was interviewed by law enforcement and child protection, said, they wanted me to do some type of sex offender programming, but my mom said, who was appellant, said I didn't need to do that. In addition, we have the additional layers of maltreatment where in the years intervening and then during the active 2020 investigation, when the victim in this case was essentially crying out for help, having mental health crises, saying she was uncomfortable in her own home, which led eventually to suicidal ideation and needing to be hospitalized. If you look at Exhibit 7, which are her very extensive hospitalization and mental health records, she was very, very clear with the mental health staff at Prairie Care that her mental health symptoms were not caused by the fact that she had to be interviewed at Coroner House. They were caused by the fact that she was inside of the home with her brother, that her mother and her brother were blaming her for this whole case opening and for breaking apart the family. Her mother was telling her she just needed to get over it and that there was nothing wrong, and that the victim was very clear that she felt that appellant was essentially sticking up for her brother and refusing to remove him from the home. And she said, I believe one of her quotes was, the only reason I want to live is to see justice metered out and to see my mom stick up for me. So those are all very clear examples of how not only did appellant fail to address the root cause of the problem, but then also made it even worse by taking aggressive actions towards her own daughter, by blaming her and favoring the perpetrator in this case, which only further exacerbated the trauma that she suffered at the hands of the perpetrator. So for all of those reasons, I do feel there is ample evidence in the record that appellant neglected her daughter, and it led not only to risk to her emotional and mental health safety, as clearly evidenced by her suicidal ideation and hospitalization, but also had pointed out, even though the abuse had ceased years prior, there was still an ongoing risk of that sexual abuse starting up again. He was an untreated sex offender, and even in the perpetrator's own interview, when the police asked him, you know, is it possible you could reoffend, his answer was, I believe direct quote was, everybody's capable. So there was not only the risk of ongoing sexual and additional sexual abuse, but the clear evidence of neglect and maltreatment from the emotional abuse that this child suffered at the hands of appellant. Let's see what other arguments I wanted to address. I would like to address the argument that essentially was referenced during opposing counsel's initial argument. And in their brief, they're essentially arguing that even if we did assume that this 2016 report was made and was screened out, that that is somehow a bar to this 2020 investigation. And as I explained in my brief, the 2020 investigation was not solely an investigation based on the fact that sexual abuse occurred in 2016. As I just explained, the 2020 report was based on new, current concerns about how the sexual abuse from 2016 was still impacting and negatively hurting this child in 2020. And in fact, in the middle of the investigation, a new report had to be made due to appellant's failure and refusal to remove the perpetrator from the home. So it is very clear that, well, there is a bit of an overlap because sexual abuse was at the crux of both of these investigations. They were focused on very different concerns that existed in 2016 and then persisted in 2020. And also, there is absolutely no support in the law, and appellant is unable to point to any, that says even if a report is screened out, it can't then be reassessed under different circumstances, under different facts, and then be screened in later. There is simply no bar in the law and no legal support for that argument.
Well, and didn't the 2016 report wouldn't have been about the appellant in this case? I mean, isn't there also sort of a nuance here, which the 2016 wasn't about appellant's conduct, it was about the conduct of the son. And so, I mean, this is a completely different case, even in terms of who the person is that's being investigated. If we look at, you know, I think that it would be distinguishable from a different case where perhaps it was the same individual that would have been investigated at both junctures.
I completely agree, Your Honor. I think there's the distinction here of a report that TE sexually abused the victim, and there's a report against appellant for that she failed to respond appropriately once she learned of the sexual abuse. Those are two very distinct things. And as I pointed out in my brief, at the end of this investigation, there was a maltreatment finding that sexual abuse occurred, but it was not against appellant. It was against TE. The only maltreatment finding, which is this appellant has a standing to appeal, and the only one at issue here, is that the fact that she neglected her child after learning about the abuse in 2016 and in the intervening 4 years, and then currently during the 2020 investigation. So with the proper scope, it is very clear that appellant, there was new and independent grounds for maltreatment, and there was substantial evidence to support the commissioner's finding that maltreatment did occur in this case. So for all of those reasons, I would respectfully ask that the commissioner's decision be affirmed. I see I have a few seconds left, but I'd be happy to yield the rest of my time unless there are any additional questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal, and I forgot to remind you to identify yourself and your client for the record, so if you'd start by doing that, I would appreciate it.
Absolutely.
My name is Aaron Roy, A-A-R-O-N, last name R-O-Y. I represent the appellant, Marin Erickson, who is present in the courtroom. Right. Thank you. I wanted to take this chance to address a few pieces here addressed by counsel in her response. First of that, there was an indication that the call into Child Protection 2016 did not occur. There is evidence in the record that that call did occur. In fact, there was a call log submitted, and being that this case happened 4 years after the original call, there was limited record of that, but there was an 11-minute call that was placed and submitted by the court. The agency contends that this could have been her on hold, this could have been her reporting a different matter. This is pure speculation. I think that there is substantial evidence that she did make this call.
But, even if that's true, you cited 260E.16 as a timeline for screening that the welfare agency's supposed to screen it in or out as soon as possible, but in no event longer than 24 hours after the report is received. I mean, that's not a statute of limitations. That's really more of a statutory obligation on the agency to act quickly rather than there's nothing in the statute, at least that I see, or the statutory scheme that says if something is screened in or out within that timeline, that then the agency is barred. And again, that would fly in the face of the entire child protection system in Minnesota that, you know, to claim that somehow you're too late to do anything about this. I mean, right? I mean, wouldn't you agree with that?
Right, and that goes to the point that the court had addressed that the new and independent grounds of the 2020 case were heavily rooted in the original 2016 case. The agency wouldn't be able to substantiate maltreatment against Ms. Erickson if they weren't able to substantiate the allegation of sexual abuse, being that...
Does it even really matter? I mean, to Judge Larson's point, you know, I mean, I don't even know if it really matters if the underlying, at least for one piece of the maltreatment determination, if the underlying conduct even really occurred, right? I mean, you have a child that's in mental health crisis who's explaining that the sources of the mental health crisis include the person which she's residing with and her responsible parents' response to it. So, I mean, let's assume that everything you're saying is true. Why isn't that in and of itself enough for the maltreatment determination?
And so I think it does matter whether that occurred because there's things like the agency specifically cites the lack of a psychosexual being completed in sex offender treatment, everything like that. That those are held against Ms. Erickson in their determination that she didn't follow all the directions of the agency. If these allegations were immediately thrown out and they were disproven and that maltreatment wasn't substantiated, they would have an extremely hard time substantiating maltreatment by Ms. Erickson. Because at that point, it's going to be making sure that her daughter gets the proper therapy, that she gets admitted into this partial hospitalization program, things she did. And so I think that they're so intertwined that we can't say, even if we believe nothing happened, that there's no maltreatment here, because that's just not true.
I have a question about, Mueller argues that the agency's revival of the previously screened out report is a due process violation, specifically procedural due process violation. But was that issue raised before the agency?
Not at the fair hearing.
Okay, was it raised before the district court?
I think it was. It wasn't as artfully laid out as it was in our appellate.
Were there arguments made supported by a case law as to how it's a procedural due process violation?
To the district court?
Correct.
Not that there was a due process violation, no.
Okay, so isn't that issue waived then before us?
I don't believe so. I think, like I said, it wasn't.
Why not? Because if it's not raised below, we don't consider issues that were not raised below for the first time on appeal.
Right, and I don't think it was as artfully raised, but it was referred to by the prior investigation and how it was screened out. So I think it was.
That doesn't necessarily mean that an argument was made a challenging and trying to exclude it because it's a procedural due process violation. That's just making it more statement of fact of what had occurred before.
Right. And this court does have the authority to consider new issues if prejudicial errors are obvious from the record, and that's Barnes v. State and Brox v. State. And so I do think as reviewing the record here, and especially with this court reviewing the limited record that it has, that these prejudicial errors are apparent, that through this original report that was apparently screened out, that later got to the agency 4 years later, that they needed to substantiate this first report in order to substantiate maltreatment against Ms. Erickson. I think that is apparent from the record, and therefore this court does have the authority to review it. Got a few seconds left if anyone has any further questions.
I don't see any. Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your argument in this matter. We will issue an opinion in the time prescribed by statute. And with that, it concludes our calendar for the morning. So we are adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you. All rise.